Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau will be along in just a minute to talk through all the week's security news headlines. And then we'll be hearing from Dan Guido in this week's sponsor interview. Dan is the head honcho over at Trail of Bits, and he'll be joining us to talk about voting apps, mobile voting, that sort of thing. Trail of Bits, of course, is the consultancy that ripped apart the Votes app and found a bunch of criticals in it. And Dan has some really interesting stuff to say about voting security, so do stick around for this week's sponsor interview after this week's news segment, which starts now. And Adam, it's all on in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, there's been reports from the authorities in the Czech Republic that there is some kind of impending, like not yet happened.
Impending, imminent attacks, large imminent. Scale against the healthcare sector, right? Right?
Yeah,
right.
Which, I mean, if you know it's going to happen, maybe you could make it not happen. It's all, the reporting's a little bit unclear as to exactly what the deal is. Like, there's some discussion of some spear phishing kind of preparing the way. There's some discussion that maybe there's some ransom, some... like disk wiper malware, but maybe, I mean, I guess maybe there's some malware that they found that's going to wipe disks that has a particular trigger date, and they're not sure how widely it's been deployed or something like that. But it's all, I was left reading this not really clear what's going on in the Czech Republic. But
I was also underwhelmed. We don't really know what's happened here. We need to turn it down a bit, because the headline here from Reuters is Czechs warn of imminent large scale cyber attacks on hospitals. That's a big headline. And there's nothing really in the story that suggests the headline should be that big. You know, there's the NÚKIB cybersecurity watchdog in the Czech Republic publishing some IOCs and malware samples that Reuters then had Area 1 have a look at. And you remember them from the Burisma, you know, New York Times piece that they were providing some, what I thought was problematic information in that case. So they've had Area 1 look at it and say, yes, it is a wiper. And this is blown up.
Yeah, it has. And I, it does seem a little bit kind of confused and...
But the word that comes to mind for me is thin,
It does seem pretty thin, And it's always hard to know when you see write-ups like this, whether it's, it is genuinely for real and it's been kind of, the way that it's reported, it's very hard to tell between, it's hard to tell between reports in mainstream media that are based on solid information but are filtered through the lens of not really knowing that it's whether or not, what solid information looks like, or whether it's kind of spun with the same language and we don't really know what the material behind it is. And, it could be someone misinterpreting, some spear phishing that actually isn't that targeted. We see that all the time. People think that they're special and they're targeted when actually it's the same thing. It just kind of looks sophisticated because it's better than average, or whether there's something really concrete. And we just don't know yet.
No, we don't. We don't. But this didn't stop the United States Secretary of State putting out a very serious statement. Now, look, I've spoken to a bunch of people about this whole thing, right? And the impression I get is that there was something to the Czech claims, but, that it has been overplayed. But nonetheless, this was a good excuse for Pompeo to send this sort of signal, right? Basically, what he's said is like, we see that people are trying to attack our friends in the Czech Republic, and there'll be consequences if they do that. States should act responsibly. The ones who don't will be punished. It's strong stuff, but you can't say that there's anything in here that you could really disagree with. I mean, it is just making that stance clear that people who attack healthcare infrastructure at this time are probably going to wind up biting off more than they can chew.
Yeah, and I think, we've certainly seen that rhetoric sort of ramping up, I suppose. I mean, there's a lot of people who are pretty zero tolerance would aspire to be, because obviously actually implementing that is a bit more difficult. You have to have the necessary info and capability and stuff. But yeah, I mean, we've seen this kind of signaling from the US and some of the other Five Eyes and some action on behalf of some of the other Five Eyes, obviously. It seems to be kind of, an excuse to send that message again.
Yeah, it does. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't even know if Pompeo was trying to lend credibility to the statement around the Czech Republic stuff, or if it was just that, an excuse. And, some people have said the rumor is that it was DPRK involved in some of this activity. Other people say they don't know, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, anyway, it was a weird thing where you see that story. And I remember seeing the story. I saw the Reuters version once and I'm just like, this thing scans weird. Did you have that impression as well? Because I just read that story and I'm like, this doesn't feel right immediately.
Yeah, exactly. That was I, you know, like, where's the detail? Like, what's actually happening? And it, you know, it just felt thin.
Yeah, it gave me the heebie-jeebies as well. Now, meanwhile, we have a couple of senators, a few senators in the United States who are kind of leaning on Cyber Command and CSER to, quote, unquote, do more to deter coronavirus-focused hackers. I mean, you know, obviously this comes in wake of ASD here in Australia targeting criminals who are doing COVID-19-related, you know, phishing lures and whatever and impersonating the government. It did drop off for a while. I did see some talk on Twitter of another round of SMS phishing going around, and it looked pretty pretty convincing. It was like, you know, get your stimulus money here sort of thing, click through, and it was quite well done. I would expect that ASD would have taken action against them already. So, I mean, look, it's going to take a while for us to know how effective this is when agencies like Cyber Command and ASD actually get involved in, you know, combating crime.
Yeah, and of course, we, you know, by design, we're not really going to see the output of that. Like, it's not like a normal law, you know, legal process where we're going to see people, you know, on trial and that kind of thing. Like, it's going to be done like the rest of intelligence, you know, in the shadows. And, you know, we're just not going to see, except that there'll be some gaps where, you know, some of those campaigns that were going to happen don't. And that's
I feel like there's room for a little bit of transparency here because we're not dealing with national security issues per se. I don't see why ASD couldn't put out a report saying, you know, we popped X number of shells and RMRF'd X number of C2s, you know? Like, they could do that.
I mean, they could, but, you know, leopards don't change their spots, right?
They're used to operating. It's not their reflex, yeah.
No, it's not. And, I mean, you know, always they're, you know, they're sensitive about sources and methods and all of the things that, you know, they want to protect their secret shells being more elite than everyone else's shells or whatever. You know, and you can kind of understand that. But, yeah, it would be nice, you know, I guess, you know, there's some middle ground between, you know, full legal process and extrajudicial drone killings, and hopefully in the middle ground, you know, we can maybe get a little bit of visibility as to what's being done in our name, you know, without the, you know, the it being too detrimental to their actual operational capability.
Well, I mean, what I've seen this compared to is actions taken by, you know, various Western countries, I think primarily the United States, against Somali pirates, you know, targeting oil tankers and whatnot. And I think that's a metaphor that fits, to be honest, because it is that sort of criminal activity that's kind of interfering in an unacceptable way with, with the functioning of the world at large.
Yeah, and I think that is a reasonable comparison, you know, and I would be, you know, obviously I'm interested to see what actually gets done and who gets shelled and how effective it is, because, I mean, that's, you know, RMing a few C2s, you know, maybe that makes a big deal if those things are spun up a hand, but maybe the groups these days, you know, they have Ansible deploy these things for them and it's no big deal, right? We don't know how effective that is. So, I mean, I would be interested to see, you know, actually what it looks like.
Sure. I mean, I did have someone come to me recently and say, oh, well, you see, the ASD stuff was for naught because this new phishing campaign is going around. I'm like, yeah, what do you think's happening to them right now? Like, so yeah, I don't think it's a fair fight between most of those phishing crews and the average ASD operator, to be honest. And it did occur to me that some of them who'd be tasked with this stuff would be quite enjoying it, because can you imagine, Adam, if you were given like legal impunity to go after some of these idiots?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a fun day at the office. Yes.
Oh, now speaking of a fun day at the office, the United States is offering to pay a different kind of bounty, Adam.
Yes, they have put out a report summarizing a bunch of the North Korean cyber activity and kind of, you know, laying out it all in one, you know, one kind of document for everyone to understand. But yeah, there's a little nugget at the end, which is that if you have some information that would lead to more, you know, insight into North Korean cyber operations, then you may be eligible for a reward up to $5 million from the Department of Justice. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of like bug bounties, but in, you know, it's one of those unsolicited bug bounties, where you can hack stuff and get paid and maybe be doing the world good. I don't know.
I have this information. Where did you get it from? Don't worry about that. I have this information.
So yeah, if anyone's sitting on that kind of stuff or happens to have some shells and you'd like a little bit of money, then Uncle Sam may in fact pay you for those shells.
There you go. We've seen details of another exploit targeting Uyghur Muslims in and around China hit the news, Adam.
This is a kind of a bug chain in WebKit, the mobile WebKit, as used on iOS, you know, by all the browsers on iOS, that would lead to CodeExec when you browsed a website that had the exploit in it. And we had seen it, reporting is that it had been deployed in, you know, a bunch of places that are common amongst, you know, Uyghurs and the diaspora And yeah, getting people's iOS phones shelled up to, I think, what, 12.4 it got patched. But yeah, drive-by exploits against the browsers on iOS, you know, those are pretty real bugs and probably cost someone a pretty penny.
Yeah, I do see lines in here, though, where they're saying, oh, the new exploit allows them to, you know, target emails from the Proton Mail app and images transferred via the Signal app. That's not the exploit doing that, guys. That's the, it just drives me nuts for some reason when people get this sort of terminology wrong. And it's Catalan, too. You're better than this, man.
That was also my complaint reading this article. I wasn't going to break it up. But yeah, like that confusing payload with delivery mechanism. Yeah, we can do better than that.
Yeah. I mean, we are kind of being a little bit nitpicky, but, that's our prerogative, nerds, okay?
That's what we do.
Yeah. And I should say, yeah, too, normally when these exploits turn up, they are affecting the diaspora, not necessarily people inside China. So just thought I should clarify that. What have we got here? We got hackers targeting oil producers, according to Dan Gooden at Ars. What did I see? Oil prices overnight hit like minus $34 because no one can store it at this stage or something. So I don't know. You know, go hack oil companies so that you too can, I don't know, wind up giving them money. Is that how it works in the current market?
I don't even know anymore. But this campaign was, you know, really quite targeted for the industry. You know, good, relatively good quality fishing seems to be doing the rounds. They're impersonating, for example, the Ministry of Petroleum from Egypt, you know, putting out tenders and, you know, asking people to, you know, fill in paperwork for oil tankers arriving in the Philippines. You know, like stuff that's pretty detailed fishes. And of course, we've seen a bunch of groups targeting the oil and energy sector in general. You know, if you do wonder what pretty good quality targeted fishes look like, this campaign does seem like it's a, you know, good example.
And is this money or other?
Well, it's hard to say. Like, they're fishing for code exec and then onwards for access. So, you know, who knows what they do once they're in there, you know? I mean, there's lots of options.
And meanwhile, in Azerbaijan,
there's some malware doing the rounds in Azerbaijan attempting to own SCADA systems. But the funny thing is that, you know, obviously SCADA malware these days, not so much of a, campaigns targeting systems that have access to SCADA, not particularly unusual. This one appears to be notable because it contains like Shakespeare in it. Some sort of, you know, erudite hacker. I don't know who's going after Azerbaijan.
This one could have been the skateboarding dog this week, really. It's a story from Lorenzo. I've already pre-warned him that I was gonna maybe, you know, take the piss out of this one a bit. He's got a story up here saying hackers are selling a critical Zoom zero-day exploit for $500,000. And to that, Adam, all I have to say is tell him he's dreaming.
There's two parts to this free market process, right? There's the person selling and there's the person buying, and they have to kind of agree on the price.
They do. I mean, I've got a water bottle on my desk. I've been drinking out of it for about a year. It's an old San Pellegrino water bottle. I'll sell it to you for $1.5 million, Adam. How do you like it?
I like it, but maybe no. I'll pass this one time, you know.
Do you mean it's not worth $1.5 million?
It's almost like that.
Yeah, it is almost like but that. Yeah, so, I don't know. I don't see Zoom exploits going for $500,000, do you?
No, it does seem a little bit excessive. And obviously, you know, there are people who would like Zoom exploits who don't have them, I suppose. And, you know, I guess if you're swimming in money, but honestly, but like, I mean, $500,000.
Really, $500,000? Like, why wouldn't you get the browser bug for the same price and then you could just own the box that way and then you can get up in their Zooms anyway?
Well, kind of exactly right.
And like, it just doesn't make any sense, this story.
No, we talked about Lorenzo had a story last week saying, hey, people are trying to sell Zoom zero days. And I said, well, maybe Lorenzo's got some data that we don't. And I don't know that this counts as, I mean, there's a little bit more detail here. There's some specifics about the one of the bugs being a, you know, straight up code exec once you're in a call with someone on the Zoom client. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's required there. I mean, if it was a, code exec just using a browser that's got the Zoom plugin, like a protocol handler installed, that'd probably be worth a little bit more, but certainly not $500,000. And then the other one was like a macOS bug that wasn't even RCE. So they just don't seem like, you know, $500,000 bugs to me. But, you know, someone would probably buy them, just not for that much money. Like, if you've got them, you probably can still sell them. But yeah.
Now, look, staying with bugs, this one was delicious. I saw it basically unfolding on Twitter last night. IBM having a good time.
Oh dear. Yeah, so someone found a bunch of bugs in a product called IBM Data Risk Manager, and that should tell you everything you need to know about the quality of that product. The person in question found a bunch of bugs, attempted to report them to IBM. IBM basically said, mumble, not really interested. This is not in scope for our bug bounty program or whatever else. And, you know, declined to accept the report. And so, yeah, the guy weaponized it and dropped it on GitHub and on Twitter. And there's some, you know, some pretty sweet bugs. There's some kind of a like appliance thing that you hook things up to give you risk management data. I was kind of a little confused.
I think it's like a Vuln scanner thing. Like you plug your Vuln scanners into it. Like it'd sort of be like Nucleus, but like really bad because it's made by IBM. I think it's sort of that, by IBM. That sort of thing, you know?
But yeah, like it's like auth bypass leading to code exec on the appliance, you know, with the usual sorts of, you know, hard-coded creds. The name of the product is the password. So yeah, I mean, it seems like genuine bugs. IBM has now turned around and said that actually, yes, we kind of screwed up and yes, we'll totally fix those bugs. But this is unfortunately what it's like dealing with really big vendors, like legacy vendors like that. I mean, if I found bugs in IBM products, by and large, it's just not worth the grief to tell them.
So moving on, and I should have put this with the other Zoom one, but yeah, of course, Zoom has you know, announced a whole bunch of stuff over the last week in terms of the consultants they're bringing on. They've got like Trailer Bits is on board, Alex Stamos is on board, Katie Masuris is going to be working on rebuilding their sort of bug bounty program and vulnerability disclosure program. So I mean, they've just gone out and basically hired everyone.
And it's, you know, it's kind of hard to argue with their approach. I mean, they've taken it seriously. They're clearly spending a bunch of money, and I hope that, you know, everybody who's doing this is getting, you know, a fair.
I'm sure everyone's getting some Zoom money. I mean, you got Matthew Green is doing some work for them. Bishop Fox, NCC Group, like so many.
Which, you know, is a good response, right? And Zoom will be in a good position coming out of this. You know, that's quite a lot of talent to go dump on their set of products. And, you know, overall, Zoom doesn't have a huge set of, you know, it's not like they've got 1,000 products. Like, it's not like they're a Cisco or an IBM, right? Who, if they were charged with, you know, trying to uplift all of their stuff at once, it would be just unworkable. Where, you know, Zoom's basically got one product, right? And they can, you know, it's not a simple product, but it's basically one. And they can go dump all these smart people at it, spend a bunch of cash, and they will do well. I mean, this is a good move. And
yeah, I think this is what happens when you basically give Alex Stamos a blank checkbook and say, make good. Well, you know, I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
It kind of looks like he's doing a good job.
Yeah, you know? So that's nice. Oh, now Cognizant, big company, copped a bit of Maze ransomware.
Oh dear. Yeah, no, the Cognizant's like an IT services company, and you know, they're like Fortune 500, like they're a big organization. And yeah, they've got themselves owned by some ransomware. And this is one of the ones that you know, does liberate data to hold hostage so that you pay the ransoms and stuff. And, you know, these kinds of people who are in the supply chain, I mean, they are just such a natural target to my mind, you know. And if you owned them and you were getting snapped, it would make sense to go make it look like you'd hit them with ransomware whilst you were actually there for access. Like that's what I would do if I was nation state and I was up in there, you know, for the onwards access, you know, give them something else to IR and, you know, keep off your back for a while. But yeah, these systems integrators getting owned like this is just such a bad time for their customers. I would be deeply afraid if I were a customer of any of these people, which is why we run our own infrastructure and least can.
Yeah, and there's no solution to the problem of system integrators because there's certain things that only they can do.
Yeah, I mean, they absolutely fill an important niche in the ecosystem, but we just don't give them the kind of scrutiny. You know, we let them get away with
too much,
you know,
too
much, right? Yeah. And we trust them too much. There's so much, oh, well, you know, our outsource provider takes care of it. They've got domain admin and all of our stuff.
It'll be
fine. We don't think about what that means. And, you know, it's just really hard, you know, when we're building testing scopes or red team scenarios or something, and it's like, well, we want to include the upstream service provider in scope. Well, we can't, right? You can't test across those organizational boundaries. And so they get away with it. And, you know, they are just such a natural target for everybody, you know, who wants to get into anywhere.
Yeah, no, they are, absolutely. And that's why they all are shelled all the time by everyone. Anyway, Pastebin, yep. this story, I just love this story, right? Because there's so much stuff that goes on to, shady stuff that goes on to Pastebin. People even put payloads on Pastebin and have malware like go and retrieve it and stuff, like just crazy stuff happens on Pastebin. So Pastebin a while ago released like this API based access. You paid $50 for a lifetime, you know, forever key, and you could just trawl Pastebin. So a lot of security people actually use that that access to trawl Pastebin for various things. The problem is, like, that's a lot of API activity, and basically Pastebin's come out and said, no, we can't do that anymore, and they've cut off the API, and they're looking at reintroducing like a subscription-based service, which ironically means Pastebin's business model is going to be charging security researchers for API access to troll their site for shady stuff. Which I mean, is just, I mean, come on.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's got a bow on it because really they're not doing anything wrong when you look at it, but that's perversely going to be wind up being their business model.
I mean, I guess it's a business model, you know, if it makes money, you know, if they're selling a service people want. But no, it is, I don't know. Like, I'm surprised actually how much stuff still ends up on Pastebin when everybody knows that it's getting scraped all the time by all of the security researchers. I mean, you know, we've got a Pastebin scraper that keeps an eye on stuff and lets us know when things come up. Well, we used to until the API broke. You know, everyone who uses it, you know, from shady stuff ought to be aware that it is being scraped. And I'm just surprised that so much stuff still does end up there when there's so many other Pastebins, right? I mean, the Pastebin is not a complicated web app, you know, and there's so many other places you can run it and better Pastebins and things that...
Yeah, it's the one, this is the one that gets attention from white hats, right? Like, why would you... Anyway.
Why would you use it? But yeah, I mean, clearly it is still a useful thing. And, you know, our scraper turns up stuff, you know, relatively often, or used to.
Until I cut it off.
But I mean, if their API is reasonably priced, then I guess we would subscribe. So, you know, consider yourself a customer at pastebin.com.
Yeah, but why are people, you know, as you said, why are people still using it when, you know, they're essentially getting into the business of selling those pastes via an API to people like you? Like, it doesn't work for anyone, and yet here we are. It doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for them.
Things don't need to make sense in the modern world. We've established that, right?
Jeez. Now, look,
.com business models, am I right?
The US Supreme Court looks like it's actually going to rule on the CFAA and specifically around this whole concept of whether or not violating a terms of service is a criminal offence. Now, this is something that has been sort of charged one way, found to be the other way by courts and flip-flopped back and forward so many times. You know, we've had some courts say, this is a civil thing, not really a criminal thing. Other courts and prosecutors say, no, this is absolutely a criminal thing. When you violate a terms of service, it is a criminal offence under the CFAA. And it looks like there might be some clarity coming down the line, courtesy of the Supreme Court in the United States.
Yeah, and this does makes sense that they do actually consider this. Because, I mean, the CFAA is a pretty old piece of legislation. It dates from the mid-80s, you know, before the internet was anything like what it is now and so important. And it's, you know, it's just too blunt a tool for the range of things it's used for. And I think, you know, some clarity around what this legislation means. And, you know, maybe this is just part of the process of the US getting some kind of more nuanced computer crime laws that, you know, work better for the modern world.
Now TechCrunch is reporting that hundreds of academics have backed Apple and Google's contact tracing protocol. This is something that Brett Winterford and I have been doing a lot of work on actually over the last week. I think we did speak about it last week briefly too on the show, but yeah, look, it is good, and it's people are starting to understand how it works and realize that it's good. But meanwhile, you've got France apparently pushing ahead to release an app that doesn't use this protocol because it's not available yet. So they're going to use their own and then switch over later. You got the Australian government apparently pushing ahead with its app that it started developing before the announcement of this protocol. And then maybe, I don't know, they'll switch to the Apple and Google protocol and have it like a split system, while adoption will have been damaged because the, you know, the solo developed one is going to be pretty crap and won't work that well. I mean, what's amazing to me is just Apple and Google have done something really good here. And governments are being really stubborn because they had a couple of weeks lead time on developing these things. They're not all of them are adjusting course. The UK is, a few are, but some of them are just being dumb.
I mean, you can kind of see that the government's point of view, in the sense that if they didn't start something, then they would look stupid, right? I mean, they have to, like, they clearly need to be able to do contract tracing. And, you know, they've got to start something. They can't just sit around and go, oh, well, we assume that, you know, the tech industry will just show up with something that works, which, I mean, clearly they were going to do. But, I mean, you know, you can't, you know, the government, if a government didn't start a project, that part
makes sense. Starting makes sense, but not adjusting course. Like,
agreed, right? And especially when some of the schemes that we've seen governments dream up are just kind of not in line with what's technically possible and with all of the other, you know, their privacy considerations and things, right? Because, you know, in the end, a lot of the, you know, people who charged with developing the stuff or, you know, planning it out by individual local governments is not, you know, are not really equipped in the same way that Apple and Google are to consider these things, you know, at scale with the technical realities. You know, they don't have the data and the experience. And, you know, we've seen some pretty ham-fisted, you know, everyone has to scan a QR code when they go into a shop with their phone kind of approaches that, you know, we're never going to be workable. But, you know, so long as, as you say, like, they correct course now and use what does appear to be the best of the options here, then, you know, whatever works in the end.
Yeah, that's right. I just worry that if they release their version and then do a pivot, you know, like by that point, the public perception damage will already have been done. I mean, you look at Trace Together, which is the Singapore version of this app, you know, you can't run it in the background. That's why Apple and Google needed to make these changes. You know, you can do you can run Bluetooth in connected mode, but you cannot do Bluetooth announcements, Bluetooth low energy announcements in the background on iOS, right? So people would have to walk around with this app loaded in the foreground on their phones, which is stupid, okay? And no one's going to use it.
Clearly not workable, right?
Yeah, clearly not workable. So look, I really hope that we see an 11th hour, you know, we see sanity prevailing at the 11th hour. Let's see. I think the Australian government had originally planned to release its app at the end of the week. But one thing that's funny is I think in Poland, the government submitted its own app, I think, to the to the Google Play Store, and Google hasn't let it in, right? So let's see. Let's see if Apple and Google are just like, no, we don't think this app is very good, so we're not going to put it in our app store.
Which is such a weird, like, you know.
I know.
It's such a cyberpunk future thing, right? I mean, the corporation
protecting us from the worst instincts of the government, trying to be, politically, do the politically expedient thing, not the sensible thing. But So anyway, I'm going to drop a link into a YouTube video a couple of days ago. Me and Brett and an old friend of mine, actually, who I went to university with, who happens to be a expert in mobile Bluetooth low energy applications. We did a YouTube video all about that stuff, so you can check it out in this week's show notes. There's also more details in the newsletter. If you're not a subscriber to the Risky Business newsletter, get on it because it's different stuff to what gets covered in the weekly show. It's written by Brett Winifred. It is fantastic stuff. We've ticked well over 1,000 subscribers now. Target 5,000. Get onto it. There's a link in the post for this podcast. Now, moving on, we've seen, this one's great. Someone stole $25 million worth of cryptocurrency, but they leaked their IP address while they were doing it, so they had to give it all back. Because basically these guys were like, hey, we've got your IP address. Give us back our money or you're going to prison forever.
Which, you know, I guess whatever works. This was some like money lending system built on top of Ethereum smart contracts, and you could like the bug that the hacker exploited was some kind of thing where you could basically withdraw your money from the lending platform multiple times, you know, like kind of race it, and they managed to, you know, siphon out essentially all of the money from this, you know, cryptocurrency lending platform, something like $25 million worth. And then,
we don't need banks, Adam. We don't need banks. We need freedom from the banks. Bang, to the moon. This is the future. Exactly. This is the future of money.
And then the people who are running the platform that had one of the couple of platforms that had gotten themselves robbed were negotiating with the person who had stolen it, like through the Ethereum blockchain.
Yeah.
And so people have been able to kind of watch along with these negotiations and were live tweeting them. And it's just such a, I mean, what a ridiculous world. But yeah, clearly they made some OPSEC failures and some pressure was applied. And then all of a sudden, all of the money came, I mean, to the extent that it exists in the first place, like fake money, all of the fake money made its way back again. So is that a win for the you know, cryptocurrency smart contract world? I don't know.
Yes, that's the question, isn't it? It is a philosophical question. It's a matter of perspective. I don't know who that story is good for and who it's bad for. It's hard to tell. Moving on, we've got some details of some research into FPGA hardware, right? So walk me through this one because I wasn't exactly clear on what this bug is or this research is about.
So yeah, this is actually really interesting. I don't know that the write-up really did it justice because it's kind of a niche sort of topic. But yeah, the basic deal is some researchers from a couple of universities in Germany have been looking into the mechanisms by which FPGAs encrypt their firmware. So if you have an FPGA chip that is a piece of programmable silicon, you know, hardware, you can kind of program it to have a specific gate layout at runtime, and then it can execute, you know, commands like a regular chip would, you know, at hardware speed, but with the flexibility of software. It's kind of the basics of the FPGA. So it loads its, you know, configuration that defines the gate layouts, you know, usually off an external flash chip. And if you have access to the hardware, typically you can modify that bitstream and have it loaded onto the FPGA and change the behavior of the hardware. And we've seen people use that for, you know, repurposing hardware to do other things, because these are quite general purpose bits of equipment. Manufacturers having had, you know, mechanisms for kind of encrypting and signing or macking the bitstream as it gets loaded into the FPGAs from the flash chips and things around to stop you being able to nick the contents of the FPGA to make your own, you know, to copy the widgets or steal IP or whatever, steal key material, or to change the behavior. These researchers looked into and came up with actually quite a cool cryptographic attack against the decryption and macking mechanism on Xilinx, some Xilinx FPGAs. And it's like proper crypto hacks, right? They're using the CBC mode, you know, like bit flipping to change encrypted instructions to then copy contents of the decrypted, you know, the image as it gets decrypted into a register that then survives a processor reboot. So they have a mechanism where they feed in a modified bitstream, get one 32-bit word into a register decrypted, and then reset the CPU, pull the contents of it out, and then do the next bit, and as a result, use the FPGA's key material as a decryption oracle to get the contents of its own firmware out of it, which is pretty smooth. I mean, it's super niche. No one's going to do it, you know, other than, you know, the sorts of people who run hardware, you know, kind of, you know, game console modding, or, you know, the sorts of people who are doing really detailed hardware hacking will probably care about this, but it's just really cool research. And one of the few examples of things getting hacked, you know, through bad crypto.
Yeah, I mean, Xilinx stuff, I remember playing around with that in at university in the 90s, right? So Xilinx FPGA stuff has been around forever.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly one of the two big FPGA manufacturers. I mean, they're in, you know, it's either them or what, Intel's Altera, I think, is the other big vendor. Mm. But yeah, I mean, everything that has, you know, I mean, everything with a programmable CPU in it is probably one of these days. So, yeah, it's pretty much everywhere. But
well, and we're starting to see more of this sort of stuff pop up in cloud environments, right? As, like, you know, you can rent your FPGA arrays for specific accelerated, you know, there are accelerated applications that you need to run custom hardware for. You just throw, you know, what you want burned onto the FPGAs in there, and then off you go.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's lots of classes of problem where these are a really interesting way to approach it. And yeah, I mean, even just copying the contents of FPGAs to be able to use to make your own clone devices, I imagine is a pretty big thing in certain, you know, areas of Shenzhen.
What else have we got here? We've got a story from ZDNet that says, talking about a CISA warning out of the Department of Homeland Security. They're saying, yeah, you might have patched your Pulse Secure VPNs, but that doesn't matter because people already got in through them, dumped all your creds, and now you're going to get wrecked.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what hackers do. And I think it's, you know, it's a good reminder to people that, you know, the bug, the entry point kind of isn't that important, right? It's what happens afterwards. And there is way too much focus in our industry on, you know, on the exploit, on the way.
Yeah, so
in.
If you patch it, that exposure didn't mean anything. And it's like, well, actually.
Well, actually, yeah. So no, it's a good reminder for people, because people do just go, well, we fixed the bug, therefore we don't have to go look and see who already nicked our TGT.
In this case, it does look like there was a lot of owning going on with Pulse Secure that is just now being acted on, right? Like, so there has been a lot of cred dumping and stuff. I believe DHS has even put out tools for people to be able to check for various indicators here.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when there's a high-profile bug like this in a, you know, piece of external access equipment, you know, there is always going to be a race to be the people who get in, you know, shore up some future way to use it for when you need it, and then come back and triage what you got later. Because, yeah, time is very much of the essence when you got a bug like that, you know, that you know is going to get patched out from under you real quick.
Yeah, so if you're sitting there thinking, phew, you know, we were a little bit late on that Pulse Secure thing, lucky no one exploited it, turns out... Turns out.
How do you know no one exploited the job?
That's right.
Look.
So chase down those tools, everyone. Have a look. Mm-hmm. What else have we got here? The German government has lost, by the looks of things, lost a fair bit of money based on a COVID-19 phishing attack targeting people who are supposed to be getting, like, what, support payments from the government?
Yeah, this was there was a set of phishing emails that would phish people for the details you needed to sign up to get payments from the government, you know, for COVID-19, and they were just phishing the contents, you know, phishing the details, and then applying for these grants or, you know, these payments and putting in their own bank account details, the attacker's bank account details, and absconding with the money. And the there was no other kind of really strong authentication requirements, you know, by this particular region of Germany for doing that. So, yeah, they got themselves scammed.
Yeah. The Tor project has laid off a third of its staff. I think we're going to see more headlines like that. I mean, not-profits have been hit pretty hard. I mean, a lot of these endowments and stuff, they are, you know, they're all up in the stock market, right? So when you see a big market crash, they have less money to donate to projects like Tor. That's not everything, you know, like not all of them are sort of, not all of them have their fortunes linked to the share market. But as I say, I would expect that we will see more of that over the next year. And talk me through this one. This is another Dan Gooden piece from Ars Technica about a supply chain attack on Ruby Gems.
Yeah, there's a report of a bunch of, you know, packages with, you know, sort of name collision type things in the Ruby Gems archive. You know, basically stuff with taking packages that have an underscore in the name and making a fake package with a hyphen in the name. This particular attack is only really interesting because it had a payload which was stealing cryptocurrency things. It would, when you ran any package that had been, you know, any one of these fake packages, it would drop a tool on your Windows box that would monitor the clipboard for like cryptocurrency for Bitcoin addresses and then substitute in its own Bitcoin address, which is such a, you know, it's quite a specific payload, and in fact so specific that no money at all has gone to that Bitcoin address. So, you know, womp womp.
Womp womp. But that was some work from Tomislav Maljak, did the analysis there, not the actual crimes, of Reversing Labs. So well done, Tomislav. And this next one, some really, really fascinating research out of White Ops, which of course is a company that does a lot of work with media, I guess, and like a lot of work around click fraud and stuff like that. This was cool. This is my highlight for the week. One of them.
Yeah, this was research into a group that had been defrauding like ad placement tech for
server-side ad insertion for smart TVs. This is so cool. They scammed server-side ad insertion for smart televisions. So smart televisions were actually useful to someone. It's amazing.
Well, exactly right. But what was interesting, I thought, was the percentage. Like, this was a fairly significant percent of all ads served through some of these platforms were completely fraudulent, which, you know, who knew online advertising was a scam? But, yeah, I mean, making real money too by the look of it.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know who's actually using these ads, right? So like, but if you can find a way to like fraudulently consume them, fraudulently play, you know, just the usual ad ecosystem stuff, it's really cool to see that.
And it does seem like it was pretty much like set your user agent to say you're a rock you and then request an ad and get paid, right? It didn't seem like it was particularly technically complicated, but...
But that's what I like, you know, it is someone spent time to read the spec, you know? and then they're like, oh, there's money here. There's gold in them there hills, Adam, gold. So I thought that was cool. Just mentioning this briefly, CyberScoop reports that the FBI has said that coronavirus scientists are big targets for foreign cyber espionage, which is something that we may have mentioned once or twice on this show over the last couple of months.
Well, certainly breaking news.
Shocking. Yes, breaking news. Thank you to our friends at the Bureau. What else have we got? Oh, this one's cool because someone has developed, it's CyberArk, right? Who they have released a tool which is designed to detect a persistence technique for AWS that I didn't know existed. And the reason I wanted to talk about this story is because the persistence technique is really cool.
Yeah, so there's a mechanism in AWS where you can like generate temporary access tokens for things. So when you have a task that needs to happen, it needs to be authorized to talk to the Amazon APIs, and you can generate a temporary token that's valid for a short period of time for whatever, you know, service, you know, whatever thing that's happening for it to go away and do this stuff. And those, of course, are kind of different to regular user accounts or roles or, you know, the rest of the access infrastructure. And when people are doing incident response on AWS, they're going to go and look at what users have logged in, what have they done, that kind of thing. These token systems, these temporary tokens, the mechanism that they were using here for using this for persistence was to have a token that is valid for a short period of time and then towards the end of its lifetime just gets itself another token.
It's glorious. I love it. I just love that. This endless loop of temporary tokens spawning new temporary tokens.
And the thing is, it's one of these, you know, everything old is new again sorts of things. Because, I mean, I've used self-rescheduling at jobs for the same sort of thing on Unix boxes.
Nice.
You know, to have yourself get persistent execution over time in a place that admins wouldn't normally think to look at. But, yeah, CyberArk's researchers have come up with a tool that will detect or, you know, look for this kind of thing in your AWS environment. So, yeah, if you're stuck rolling incident response in AWS, then number one, I feel bad for you. And number two, yeah, maybe add this to the list of things that you want to have a look for, because, yeah, it's a smart idea.
It is a smart idea. Had you heard of that technique before, the token thing?
I had never seen it used in this mechanism, but of course, yeah. it's a sensible, I mean, it makes sense.
It makes sense. You just read it and you're like, huh, reminds me of some of your non-root Unix user land tricks, actually, Adam. The thought may have occurred to me. But anyway, what else have we got?
I didn't do it.
We've got a whole bunch of Nintendo accounts getting popped and used to buy like Fortnite currency and all this sort of stuff. It's like, this is just the sort of crime you get when like every teenager in the world is stuck at home, right?
although it does seem a little bit unclear exactly how these accounts are getting owned, because I mean, yeah. you know, you would expect just, you know, credential stuffing. People will be using creds from other places, but there do seem to be some people who have single factor auth but are using, you know, password safe generated credentials and that kinds of thing that are getting their accounts popped. So, you know, maybe there's something more to this story or not. It's kind of hard to say, you know, but either way, a whole bunch of people are losing a bunch of money, you know, on their linked credit cards for, you know, Fortnite currency and that kind of thing.
Man, some of this stuff is crazy. Like, I remember listening to, you know, Jack Rosider, Darknet Diaries. He did his fantastic series on the Xbox Underground. And there was one person.
Oh, yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, it was, eh? And there was that one person who made like millions of dollars by selling FIFA gold. Like, that was their thing. And it was like, it wasn't necessarily entirely illegal. I think it was like one of those gray area things. Well, the Supreme Court will tell us soon, I guess. But, you know, like millions of dollars in FIFA gold because they just figured out a way to mint it using like, you know, I think they were dev Xboxes or something. I could be remembering that wrong. But yeah, go listen to that, everyone, if you haven't already.
Yeah, that is a really good couple of episodes. I really enjoyed that as well.
It worked beautiful. Now, I've linked through to a reading item this week, and that is part one of our three-part analysis of the Cyber Solarium Commission report. That is a bit of work done by Brett Winifred, who works for Risky Business. So yeah, part one is like 3,000 words. It includes an interview with the person who led the commission and all sorts of other people as well. It is, you know, it's a great read. If you were interested at all in cyber policy, you know, take a look at this one. The headline is "Deterrence in Cyberspace Isn't Working, So What's Next?" So yeah, look, very, very interesting stuff. I've linked through also to this week's newsletter and to the subscription page for that. But yeah, mate, that's actually it for this week's news. That was a fun one, man. Like last week was a bit meh because it was like we were a bit thin for good stories. But this week was really cool. So yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Yeah, I'll talk to you then, Pat. See you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dan Guido of Trail of Bits. Trail of Bits are a security engineering and consulting firm. And they're one of the firms that just picked up a gig with Zoom, actually. So congrats to all of you there at Trail of Bits for that. And yeah, the last high-profile thing they did before this Zoom gig was their audit of Votes, the Votes mobile blockchain-based voting app, which you would have heard talked about on the show a few times. So a short time after MIT dropped a report saying the app has some glaring security problems, Trail of Bits dropped its report into the app, and it turned out they'd been commissioned to test Votes by a philanthropic organization. So I started off by asking Dan to explain how he wound up being commissioned to test the Votes app and how he was able to release his team's findings publicly. Here's what he had to say.
The story is a little bit weird. I ran into the Tusk philanthropy folks at Black Hat last year. I had a really eventful Black Hat last year between Time AI and this meeting. But I met the Tusk folks that are funding their mobile voting project, where they have this mission to expand access to mobile voting technology across the United States and possibly across the world. In that discussion, they described a lot of kind of difficulties they had in understanding the real concrete security issues in the technology they were investing in, and they wanted help from a team of experts. They had a couple other security firms they were working with, but the specific knowledge that those teams had of the underlying technology was limited. And we arrived at the right moment in time to really help them answer those questions. So that's where the discussion began. And they introduced us to Votes.
So they were investors in Votes, or they were funding Votes? I mean, what's the connection there?
So they try to avoid investing in any of the companies that they're helping. What they want to do instead is facilitate pilots. They want to facilitate security reviews. They want to provide an environment where these companies can succeed.
So they're not investors, but they are important to votes, which is, I'm guessing, how you were able to be lumped onto votes as auditors, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of these small companies that are trying out mobile voting and doing pilots, they're not making a ton of money. They don't operate with a huge budget. They're not like funded by the government. They have real financial constraints. So when Tusk shows up at their front door and says, hey, we will pay for all the costs for you to do a pilot with this locality, it's an amazing deal for them. And it's an amazing deal for the locality. Like most local jurisdictions or even states don't have the kinds of budget that allows them to experiment with election technology or really upgrade things that are 10 and 15, 20 years old. So when somebody shows up and they offer even a modest amount of money to help improve access to voting systems, it's a big deal. And that's what Tusk has done.
Yeah. So, I mean, between MIT's work on their app and your work on their app, I mean, they've been kind of like, you know, they've been shredded pretty good. Let's just say that. And definitely, you know, their app, which was kind of the market leading app, right? Until recently, you know, it's definitely not ready for prime time. I mean, meanwhile, we've done a bunch of work on, you know, election security stuff, and everyone seems to say the same thing, which is app-based or internet-based voting, certainly not ready for prime time. And, you know, mail-in elections are going to be the thing this year. So, you know, that begs the question, where to from here for app-based or internet voting? So that begs the question, where to from here? I mean, one of the things that has been suggested to me is, you know, people in this space would like to see an agency like DARPA, perhaps, you know, pump out some grants to pay for some people to engineer, you know, like e-voting frameworks and things that then app developers can go and use, sort of along the lines of what Microsoft has done with its voting machine technology. Is that where you think this thing is going to go? Is that where you think it should go?
I think that a lot of people think that this is a really easy solution to come to, that there's not a whole big challenge to be able to vote online. People do banking online. They manage a lot of their finances online. They do, like, people live online. And especially right now, everyone's remote. They've got a computer and a home office set up, and everything they used to do in an office in person is now being done online. So why can't this be done online too? And I think what especially security engineers don't understand are the different requirements and the extreme requirements for security on voting systems. It's not okay to have fraud. It's not okay to have one vote that's a mistake. In an election system, the requirement is perfection. And that's because there are a lot of elections that are decided by a single vote. Even when you're doing a pilot, when you're doing, you know, 500 votes at a time and you're trying to elect your town mayor, those votes count proportionally for a vast amount of the total. And the ability for somebody to manipulate that even in a single case is substantial. Also, if you do have a vote, like let's say you have a national election like back in 2000 or whatever, and you're doing this Bush v. Gore recount thing, and it comes down to like 40 voters in Florida that are deciding the entire election, deciding who's going to be president, you need to have the entire population have faith in the technology used to record votes. And there can't be any potential for failure.
You know, what's crazy is there's going to be a whole bunch of people listening to this program who are too young to know what a hanging chad is.
That's right. Yeah.
Hanging Chad, kids. Go look it up. That was the Florida Hanging Chads. Look, I get what you're saying, right? Like a bank can tolerate a bit of fraud, right? Like say they lose a couple of million a year, you know, their profits are in the billions. They don't care. Whereas in an election, that's not tolerable, right? So the security requirements here, you know, just from a design brief perspective are very, very different. I can definitely see where you're going. I mean, it's funny though that you actually mentioned banks because it made me think that like probably the best app that I use is the app, a mobile app that I use from my bank, which is, you know, making use of all the biometrics and stuff on my mobile device. And it's, you know, it's a bloody good app. I mean, what would stop, you know, governments from being able to ask some of the banks with the better apps for being able to, you know, build like a voting function into their actual apps. I guess the problem there is that the banks would get to see who people are voting for.
Yeah, that's right. So if you want to actually deploy a real online voting system, you have to meet these, you don't have to, I guess, nobody has to do anything, but you should meet these standards called end-to-end verifiability, E2EV, which is the way that the industry calls it. What that means is that your voting system needs to meet a couple of substantial requirements. You have to have a secret ballot. You have to have an auditable election. Individual voters need to be able to verify that the vote was counted correctly. So what does that mean on a more like, you know, ground level basis? It means that there can't just be a database where all the votes get recorded, and then the person who operates the database can look at who voted for who and can change individual votes. Because, you know, imagine that Trump is president and he has access to everybody that voted for him and didn't. And then just like he's doing now with portioning ventilators out to states in the United States, he can go individually harass or, you know, refuse to support people that didn't support him. So to finish the thought, like, technology systems are really bad at meeting those requirements, because on one hand, you need to be able to review all the people that voted for a candidate and prove that they voted, that the vote was counted correctly. And on the other hand, you can't actually look at the data, because if you look at the data, it violates the secret ballot principle. So what you need is, you need some really exotic cryptography, like what you're talking about. You need some zero knowledge proofs. You need some multi-party computation. You need some privacy preserving cryptography, which is the most advanced bleeding edge of cryptography that we have right now. And there are people that are trying to do this. There's the Swiss Post and the Skytel folks that have tried to implement some of that advanced cryptography. There's the Moscow election that recently occurred on the Ethereum blockchain. And this stuff is, you know, done with the best of intentions. It's done by experienced professionals. They have cryptographers that are present that are helping to write these things, and they can't get it right. And that's because it is just truly complicated, and it's on the forefront of what's possible with cryptography right now. People bring us in all the time to review these systems, and it's never a case of like, are we going to be stymied? Are we not going to find any issues? It's always that we're discovering something new. And you do need investments in fundamental research to get there.
This brings us back to the original question, which is, you know, what's the way forward here? It feels like, you know, standard startup economics aren't necessarily going to get us there. So do you think that we need an agency like DARPA to step in, pump out some grants, and, you know, get some frameworks built here for the, you know, that handle the crypto guts of what you're talking about the verifiability and all of that? Is that what needs to happen here?
Yeah, so I don't know if DARPA is the right people to give it out. I think the Election Assistance Commission, you know, NSF, those kinds of groups may be a better fit, because.
Well, yeah, DARPA, I mean, DARPA is a defense agency, right?
So, yeah. Right. So what interest do they really have in voting? The more I think about it, like, even though they give out money, they might have the right contacts. They might know the right people to talk to, but ultimately the right person to manage that process is somebody different. This is not a question of the military. It's like a civics and politics thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are the things they have to invest in? Definitely cryptography. Like, that seems to be the thing that all this rests on. And it's not a question, like, a lot of people have asked us, can't we just do some hackathon and offer a prize, like a Netflix prize, but for voting? It's not something where you're just going to sit outside, stare at the sky, and wait for an apple to hit you on the head.
Yeah, you're not going to crowdsource your way out of this one, right?
No. You need, like, a dedicated team of engineers and scientists that make progress by inches over a period of years, possibly decades, in order to figure out all the component pieces required to make an end-to-end verifiable voting system.
Decades? It's decades. Come on, man. You could get this done in a few years. Like, seriously, if it was a priority, if it was well-funded, if the requirements were set right, this is not... I mean, you look at what Microsoft... What's their framework called again, their dev kit?
Oh, Election Guard.
Yeah, you look at something like Election Guard, where a lot of this stuff is in there already. I mean, you extend that out to being an app framework instead of just a voting machine framework. It can be done.
Yeah, there are some challenges, and I'm game to help people solve them. Like, I'm here as an engineer because I want to build these things and I want to help people get there. But there's, like, we can't fool ourselves that it's not going to happen next year.
Oh, no.
Maybe
no.
Like by 2024, yeah. In the next big election, there'll be some trials of something where we've made some progress in certain areas. But yeah, I think if there were a real dedicated effort, you could probably figure out the majority of this stuff within a decade, maybe, you know, 8 years.
Yeah, that's what it feels like to me as well. Dan Guido, thank you very much for joining us. I wish you the best of luck with your work on various voting, e-voting platforms. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and we'll talk to you again later in the year.
Thanks again, Patrick.
That was Dan Guido of Trail of Bits there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Trail of Bits for its support of the Risky Business Podcast. Trail of Bits does security engineering and consulting, and you can check them out at trailofbits.com. That is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back soon with more Risky Business, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Thank you.